Any quick questions? Take about 5 or 10 minutes for questions, just for clarification. Then we're going to look at the case study and just walk through it together. Yes, ma'am. It's primarily you understanding what God is up to in suffering. And right, and that helps you as you walk with another person. But it's, what does the Bible teach about suffering? And we've got to have a theology of suffering. If we don't, we're going to be duped, because we live in a very broken world, and we live in broken bodies, and we have hearts that defect and worship and love all kinds of things other than the true and living God. Feel free to ask any question, clarification, press a point, disagree with me. Yes, ma'am.
Where in the book did you say there was a chapter about suffering?
I think it's called Truths That Will Help You.
Yeah,
my editor didn't want me to have suffering and your worry. This is where they do the marketing kind of stuff, right? We want to keep people reading. So, but I think it's, you know, I think it's a helpful piece to factor in. Excuse me? I will in just a moment. I just want to get folks talking. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, if someone is so debilitated, probably talking about roots and fruit isn't where you want to start. You want to figure out how deep this debilitation is, how long it's been going on. Maybe there are mitigating factors that we want to address first. Maybe there's a redemptive place for how medication can help this person temporarily and begin to get to a place where they can start to talk more openly and honestly about what they're struggling with. But I don't talk about roots and fruit until I ground it in all these, you know, gospel promises. Yeah. So this is a tough environment to be in with, you know, I would let y'all break, but I'm afraid you just collide into one another in this mad rush for the restroom. Yes. Excuse me? I don't address boundaries in this book, no. Tell me a little bit about what you mean. So you're in a relationship with someone who is deeply anxious? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I would say clarity and honesty up front, and then consistency. And depending on the nature of the relationship, if it's a counselee, you have a little bit more control. If it's a spouse, not so much, right? If it's a family member, you know, the closer they are in terms of their covenantal connection with you, the less control you have. Now, if it's a brother and they live in California and you're in Atlanta, you know, so all of those factors matter. But let's say you're in close proximity. I think honest, loving conversations about how you're going to approach the relationship with them and saying, look, I love you. I'm committed to this relationship. But we can't keep doing this relationship like this. And when you're ready, I'm here. I'm ready to do the relationship right. But until then, you know, we're going to have to establish some priorities. And I would say, I don't want to get too technical. Rather than using the term boundaries, I would just think of that as loving someone wisely. It has more of a positive moving towards them rather than kind of a self-protective, I've got to keep you from messing with me. And I don't think that's what the people that use the language of boundaries mean, but it can connote that. It sounds a little more negative. But for those of us who have had the experience of, you know, a lack of careful attention to those things, you appreciate that word. But no, that would be something I would say. I'm trying to think if there's some... there's actually some good stuff in a book by Dan Allender called Bold Love, where he talks about, it's in his chapter, he has loving the fool, loving the evil person, and I think it may be loving the fool or loving the evil person, and there's actually a conversation that he recounts of a daughter in relationship to her father, and she has that honest conversation with him. So, clarity, consistency. This becomes an issue, particularly in the church, where, you know, you don't have those formal professional, you know, boundaries, and so you have to think wisely about those things. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just saying this is what is offered people in general. But meditation, stopping, the way that I might cast that is thinking more in terms of how the Bible talks about Sabbath. And I not only need weekly Sabbath, I need daily Sabbath. And so how do I find time away to not empty my mind and kind of connect myself with the impersonal other, right? Like the drop of water in the ocean. But how do I fill my mind with God's truth and do more than just keep it in here, actually enable that for me to relate more intelligently with God? So, those Eastern exercises can sometimes, you know, make us nervous, but there's a rich tradition in the Christian faith of meditation. It's just a different way of meditating. Now, there's also, and I don't know much about this personally, but there's also a contemplative tradition in the Christian church, centering prayer, listening. And I have friends that benefit greatly from that. But the key is you want to talk to God, and you want to build into your life times when you're doing that. Sabbaths. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, if you're working with someone that and you know that has more of a deep struggle, they're suffering greatly. I would say what you need to do is you probably ought to start researching: are there people in this church? Are there people in this community that have case wisdom, experience, and knowledge and insight into helping people who are struggling with the, you know, more pathological experiences with anxiety and worry, and be prepared and be able to say, hey, I'm willing to walk with you at a certain level, but I'm not sure that I know how to best help you, and that's not because you're a freak. It's just because you don't want people to feel like freaks when they're struggling, right? That the shame that comes with that. But I'm here for you, and I think there may be somebody else that can partner with you and help you along with me. And they may be in the local church. They may be, you know, an external resource in the community.
That medication, because I feel okay now, my medication is getting to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
What's really
right. Yeah, what layer in those concentric circles is medication addressing? The brain. Yeah. And by the way, I don't know who referred to, I mean, modern psychiatry is like in its infancy in knowing what is actually going on up here and what these drugs that we're putting into our bodies does and doesn't do. And a lot of times people also talk about diet and exercise. Those things are equally important. We put so many toxins in our body in America, you know. My daughter went to southern France for about 4 or 5 months, and she's eating fresh foods every day, and then she comes back to the States, and it's like, ugh, what are we doing to ourselves here, right? So that's an aspect as well that's addressing physiological realities. But I would say that I don't like to see people suffer. And so if there is something that can help them, and it is so debilitating that this will help, then I'm all for that. But I want to also help them understand that, hey, here's who you are as a complex person, and this is addressing this one area. And as much as that might be helpful, and I don't know how I'd actually word it to someone, but you know, we have a higher vision for them than just symptom relief. I'm all for alleviating suffering, but I don't want to just do symptom relief and not call them to faith and obedience in the midst of their struggle. And that's a delicate thing to do with someone who's deeply despairing. You got to be very careful with someone. The last thing I do is, you know, just kind of out of nowhere, being in, you know, non-medical, no training in psychiatry, say, you need to go off your medication and do it today, right? You need to say, is it being monitored? Who are you talking to about it? Tell me how that's helping you. What changes have you seen? Have you seen side effects that aren't necessarily positive? But when someone is on medication, basically what it's saying to you is this: they are suffering. That's what it says, all right? And the last thing we want to do is shame them and say, well, if your faith were greater, you know. The thing we want to do is say, if that's helping you, great. And how can you continue to move in a direction of growing in grace in Christ and being conformed into His likeness? And you may need the medication for a while. You may not. There are certain brain dysfunctions that oftentimes mean that someone's going to be on medication probably forever. Bipolar is one of them, and schizophrenia. People come off of their medication, and it's highly problematic. Yes.
How may we buy copies of your book?
I'm sorry?
How may we buy additional copies of your book?
I don't think are there any in the bookstore? But the bookstore is not open tonight. Okay, if you're not here tomorrow, Amazon.com, the Good Book Company, the publisher, they have a office in the States, and they distribute, they're really great. Either one of those would be the place to get it. That's a really good question, by the way. I feel less anxious with that question. I can answer that one. That's right. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book is I'm trying to say, here is, if you will, the distinctive Christian resource that we bring to the struggle. And it is something that you won't find in any other therapy. There may be great techniques and skills and things of that nature that you'll find in the other therapies, but you will not find a redeeming, personal, loving, gracious God that meets the struggler in the midst of their struggle. And so that's really the vision I'm casting. I'm not trying to minimize the multi-layeredness of the struggle. Let me say something about cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT, a lot of Christians use it, and they probably, you know, Christianize it in a good way. But here's what cognitive behavioral therapy is. You replace bad thoughts with right thoughts, right? You have an activating event, and there are behaviors that grew out of beliefs that then now produce consequences, and you've got to have an argument with yourself about your beliefs to determine whether or not that really is accurate in terms of how you acted in the moment. And as you're having a debate in your own head, you're rethinking and reassessing your behavior based on those beliefs, and changing your beliefs, changing your thinking. Now, you can see how that would be very attractive to Christians. And actually, at one level, if you look at many therapies out there, CBT is a very sane therapy. The problem is, it just says that we just do cognition. Well, we're much more complex than our cognition. Freud was probably onto something in terms of subconscious or unconscious. There are deep things going on in the heart. Now, Freud took it in a really weird direction, and the Oedipus complex and all that stuff. But here's what happens. CBT, in and of itself, in its secular form, and we can actually do the same thing in Christian form, is it's you having an argument and a conversation with yourself. Okay? That was wrong thinking, wrong beliefs. I need to change that thinking. I need to change those beliefs. Here are the Bible verses that I need to insert, and here's the bad stuff that needs to get out. And what happens is you just stay in your own head. And when I talk about change, and I actually have a section in the book where I kind of am softly challenging CBT. I don't want to diss it because I'm not, this antagonistic jerk that thinks everything and everyone is wrong. But we've got to get out of our heads, our own heads. And we've got to talk to somebody besides ourselves. And that person is God. And so I talk about the change process. It's not less than cognitive, it's more. It's not less than behavioral, it's more. It's covenantal. And covenantal is just a fancy word in the Bible that means relationship. What is the Bible? What is prayer? What is Christian fellowship and encouragement? The sacraments, good preaching, teaching. What is all of that designed to do? What do we call them? We call all of those things means of grace. They're not ends of grace. They're means of grace. They're means whereby they get us talking and relating to our God, who in the context of that relationship is changing us and working in us. This vertical piece is the piece that I'm inserting into the equation when I talk about CBT. Yes. I'm not a pediatrician. I'm not a psychiatrist. I would say, if there's deep emotional dysregulation in a young child, there's probably what most people will say is there's probably a combination of some genetic and environmental factor going on. In fact, that's what they say about schizophrenia. It's some genetic predisposition and some environmental factor. And so it may be that this young child has something that is more systemic, and it will need to be addressed by a wise pediatrician or psychiatrist, but that still doesn't mean that that child can't be, an active, growing believer in Jesus. It's going to be an area where there's going to be more intense struggle, but the struggle is not without hope. Yeah, it is challenging. I mean, I think the general trajectory is encouragement and how can I pray for you and how are you doing? And if they kind of spill on you their anxieties and fears, you listen. Sometimes the best thing we can do for people is listen to them. And I don't like to listen. I love what's going on here tonight. I wish I could do this at home. That's the one place I don't get away with it. But listening is a redemptive, a very powerful redemptive thing that you can do with people. And not trying to explain them or not trying to find their idol or, you know, there's a place for that. There's a place to help people evaluate and think. But in the early stages, it's listening, it's encouragement, it's prayer, walking with them. We err on that side. And let's get to the case study. But I would say, as you build relational equity with someone, you begin to earn the right to say, "Hey, can we talk about something? You know, I've been walking with you over the past several months and been so encouraged by what's going on in your life. I mean, with all that you've been through and all that you're struggling with, you're still coming to church, you're struggling to read your Bible, but you're struggling. You haven't forsaken God. There's so many good things that are going on, and I'm so encouraged about that. And yet I see this abiding kind of struggle. Are you comfortable talking to me about that?" And you may get, "You know, I'm not really ready to go there." Say, "Okay." Or, "You know, you have really been there for me, and I need to talk about these things, but I've never been able to because no one's ever given me the kind of encouragement and no one's ever listened to me the way you have. And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, some sins and struggles." And I do need to put some things on the table. My trip to the UK. So is worry a sin? Let me share this, and then we'll look at the case study. We've got time. Is worry a sin? I just don't like that question because it's kind of a yes and no. Okay, so let's think about my trip to the UK. I'm getting ready to go to the UK, and I'm anxious, and I'm struggling with worry. My back goes out. Now, I didn't finish telling you the story. I was able to call my primary care physician, and this guy just happened to be in the office that day. He's a retired surgeon. I walk in, and he says, "Oh, I can help you. I can give you a shot in the back." Well, he didn't know that shot in the back didn't encourage me. And he said, "I'll start with the small needle, and then I'll go with the big one." My wife is sitting there, and she's like, "Oh, no." But He numbed my lower back, and he said, "If I put saline in there, it would do the same thing, but he put something else in there." He didn't tell me what. He said, "This will have a more lasting effect." But as soon as that, and I didn't know it at the time, he stuck that needle in 5 different times. And I felt it once, and he must have, like, hit right on the place where it was tight. And within 5 minutes, I was starting to stretch my back, and thankfully was able to get on the plane, and I only think I took 1 or 2 hydrocodones and, you know, maybe a Flexeril or two. I'm scared of those kinds of narcotics, but I will take them if I need them. So let me break down that experience. So you might could argue, And this is me, so I can do this, right? You might could argue that my stressing out and being anxious about the trip at some level is understandable, but there may be an element where I am, you know, worried about what people are going to think of me. And there is this over-concern. And this is where it's a struggle with idolatry and sin, okay? And I think that was probably true. I look back on it, and I was deeply anxious about whether or not I was prepared to do this. I was in the UK for 3 weeks. Loved it once I got there, but the thought of it, you know, was anxiety-producing. So I think you might be able to argue at that level there was some of that going on. There was over-concern. And then what happened is it kicked in and it began to express itself in my body. Now we're in another category. We're in a category of suffering. And now my body is experiencing pain. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but when my back goes out, I know that if I turn in one direction wrong, I'm on the floor. I mean, I've had to have the ER come and get me before. That's how bad it is. And so I'm starting to get anxious about that. Now, what's that? That's suffering. That's pain. I get to the doctor, and my wife is there, and, you know, I'm thinking, look, is there a shot you can give me? I don't like it, but I'll take it. A shot and being feeling better right away so I can make the trip is better than anything else I've ever experienced in the time it's taken to recover. But I'm suffering, and he starts talking about shots and big needles and little needles. And there's, you know, my anxiety goes up. And then he's sticking the needle in my back, and my body is getting clammy. My wife is staying there with her hand on me, and I'm getting pale. What's happening? That's deep suffering, right? Now, it may not be suffering at the level of what some other people have experienced in their lives, but there's suffering there. And so this is a place where my wife was there. She wasn't castigating me. What's wrong with you, you silly man? You know, it's just the needle. And my wife, you know, my wife's been through way more than I've ever been through when it comes to delivering kids and needles and all that stuff, you know. But she didn't castigate me and say, you know, you ought to just be like me. No, she had her hand on my back, and she was just encouraging me, right? And there's something that is to be said for human touch with fearful people. Deeply, deeply helpful and soothing. Now, I know you have to be careful, you know, with all that. But so we're looking at kind of a nuanced continuum, aren't we? When we think about is worry and anxiety a sin? Jesus is commanding us not to worry, but it's within the context of this deep commitment to us, encouragement. But we are, at some level, trying to live in two kingdoms. And that's not good. That's called, you know, covenantal unfaithfulness. It's called sinful pining after allegiances and loyalties that are not the true and living God. And I need to grow. So, you know, out of that experience, what might I conclude? You know what? I really need to be more vigilant and prayerful when I'm preparing for a big event or travel. I did the same thing coming here, you know. I was telling my wife, you know, Sunday, and I'm thinking, all right, am I ready? And I could feel myself getting agitated, manic, you know, in the car. She's like, but there's a place where I need to grow in grace, and I need to say, all right, I need to know God's commitment to me in the midst of all this, and that He's with me. Thankfully, it didn't turn into a you know, tightening of my muscles, but you see how I'm trying to capture the range of the experience of anxiety, and where you want to factor in, you know, false allegiances and loyalties, but you also want to incorporate that in with the experience of suffering. Okay, let's do this. Two things. You've got a case study in front of you, and it's Celia, and then you've got the Institute for Pastoral Care card. Here's the deal. If you want to get my e-news, or if you're interested in being on the mailing list, fill that card out and just pass them down to the front. Even if you don't fill it out, pass them all back so I can get them back, and we'll collect them in about 5 minutes. But here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to read the case study and look at the categories that I've given you. Where are we? I'm getting lost in these. Here we are. Case study. How can you help? All right. Number one, I want you to read this case study, and I want you to consider what might be my temptation as I think about helping Celia. And it could be, I might be judgmental, I might not be whatever. What are your own personal proclivities that would lead you to not be helpful to her? Your own temptations as she enters into your life. And there's Galatians 6, 1 through 5. Be careful, those of you who are going to restore another person, that you do it gently, and take heed lest you fall. Right? So there's this humility. So how might your humility be threatened, and how might you not be helpful to Celia? Secondly, begin to build a bridge. All right? This may not be a great metaphor. It's a mechanical metaphor for a relational thing, but build a bridge. How do you build a bridge? How do you care for Celia in such a way that you're building relational equity with her, you're building trust? What would that look like practically? And then cross the bridge. Go across this bridge and meet Celia in her shoes, in her skin. And I talk about this in terms of going cross-cultural. If you're going to go on a missionary trip, what are you going to do? You're going to study the continent, the values and the customs of that culture. Just think of Cecilia and every other person in your life as an unknown continent. Go cross-cultural. How will you get to know Celia and the dynamics of her struggle and the experience of her struggle? Okay? A lot of this is asking questions and loving Cecilia. And then start to walk back across the bridge with your friend. All right, you've built a bridge, you've built trust, you've gotten to know them, and they're willing to walk with you across that bridge. And then what might you talk about with your friend while you're walking together? What kind of conversations, gospel conversations, are you going to have with Celia as you help her grow in grace in this struggle with anxiety? And then the final thing is, what other resources are available to me to help Celia? Because I can't do it alone, and there's a bigger, broader body of Christ that has resources that are greater than mine, and the sum is greater than me, right? So what other resources might there be available to me to help Cecilia? So that's just getting at kind of the movement of wise and helpful and loving and gracious ministry. Watch yourself, start to build a bridge, build trust, then go cross-cultural, enter into Celia's world, get to know her, begin to walk with her back across the bridge and talk with her while you walk together. Got 1 Corinthians 5:14 there. And then think of resources that are available to further help your friend. Take 5 or 10 minutes just writing some notes. And then what I'd like for you to do is I'd like for you to pair up with someone right next to you and just share with one another some of your answers. And then we'll do that together before we end at 9 o'clock. Okay? So I want to try to give you some practical things to help you think about very, very organic, personal, helpful ministry.